Welcome to the Everyday Peacemaking Podcast. I'm Oshita Moore.
And I'm Jer Swigert. Join us as we grow our imaginations for joining God and others in mending divides.
Fear runs deep, spreading like a virus. Hate is cheap. From afar it costs you nothing. Sister, take my hand. Brother, we will stand. Open up.
Hey everyone, welcome back. So we are in the season on the church calendar called Eastertide. And this is the season that I am so grateful for. I love that it lines up as the seasons are for many of us changing into spring. But this is the season of hope, the time of the year where we get to practice hope and we get to explore the work of hope in our lives. And I mean, Jer, you know, you and I, we have a whole cohort called Journey of Hope. Hope is an important part of our peacemaking. It sustains us when things are really, really hard and we're seeing little deaths all around us. This is the season where we can look for little resurrections. So Jer and I thought that we should have a conversation of what does it look like to live into the resurrection? How do we cultivate the capacity or practice the skill of looking for little resurrections all around us? So this past weekend, as we're recording this, this follows Easter. So I preached at my church a sermon on the resurrection. And I have a bunch of pastor friends, a bunch of preacher friends, you know, Jer, maybe you saw this too. They're all posting leading up to Easter, like, don't try to overthink it. Just preach the gospel. Like, just preach the resurrection. Like, everybody's heard this story. You don't need a new angle. And as I was living into sermon writing, I was going through a week that felt like I was very much in Good Friday. Like there was a lot of loss and death and hopelessness surrounding me. And I just really needed time and the permission to sit with hope. And so that's what this conversation is about, giving you permission to sit with hope. As I taught that sermon, I had this realization that a lot of us don't know how to live into hope. We don't know what hope looks like on a practical level for us. And I had this idea or this thought that really came from some moments in that really hard week where I had to choose to live into the and. So like, I had to choose to say, yes, my life feels really hard and Christ is with me. Or yes, I don't know what I'm going to do about X, Y, Z. And I have a community that I can process. Like I had to choose the expansiveness of yes and, because what I found was when I would sit with the hard and then kind of throw a but, yes, this is really hard, but I'm all alone. Or like when I threw that kind of but stopper in there, it became a place where I could not experience any sort of creativity, any sort of expansiveness. I just didn't practice hope. It just felt like I was just giving a lot of excuses as to why I couldn't acknowledge the good in my life. And so I preached this sermon. I'm looking at the moment where the women run back to the disciples to tell them that Jesus had risen and that some of them said, oh, this is nonsense. But then Peter was like, no, I'm going to run. I'm going to go and look. And that the disciples practiced a yes, but response to good news. Like, yes, but this doesn't make any sense. But Peter practiced a yes and response. Yes, and I'm going to throw myself into it. I'm going to go see it for myself. I'm going to give myself permission to have my narrative or my story changed. And I just kept thinking about the importance of that shift in our spiritual formation from a yes, but the thing that stops that expansiveness, that hopefulness from taking root and flourishing, to the yes and. What does it look like to say yes and? But this posture of yes and is really, really important for me. It got me through a really hard week. And I think it's the posture of a peacemaker, of curiosity and hope and resurrection. So I wanted to kind of bring that and say, yeah, I think this could be something that we could noodle on and embody in our peacemaking practice in our everyday lives.
Yeah. Love the concept of resurrection inviting us into the yes and. Oshi, I think that's a really beautiful framing. And yeah, like I think optimism is possible because death and darkness didn't have the last word with Jesus. I think that's the season that we find ourselves in. And of course, living on this side of the cross and the empty tomb as we hold to by faith in our Christian tradition, you know, Christ is still alive. It's not like we physically go through the dying of God and the getting back up again. It's in the midst of this life that we live now every single day, we get to actually live into this yes and. And where that really strikes me is like this notion of peacemaking is not like pie in the sky optimism, pie in the sky hope that actually causes us to become disembodied or detached from the pain and the realities of our world. That what I love about this yes and is, yes, there are moments that feel really dark and really hard, and empty tomb means that the darkness doesn't win. The empty tomb means that love actually holds the last word, the and of that. And I think we get to live in the yes and.
Yeah.
And that's good news. And so I think you're inviting even me into this post-Easter, the world feels hard and it feels dark. And even as an undying optimist, there are times when I've been like, I don't know that I have a lot of optimism or a lot of hope, but for me, this Easter season in the midst of a dark world has invited me into, yep, it's dark. I see the world as it is, and the darkness doesn't win. It doesn't get the last word. And the reason being is because we as resurrection people, we as everyday peacemakers are invited into, as you say, the little resurrections, or we're invited into what I think Jesus talked a lot about in terms of mustard seeds and yeast, like these small moments of life springing about around us in sometimes really sensational ways and sometimes probably more often more mundane ways. And that's what I'm kind of curious with you as you talk about little resurrections. I'm nervous about the concept of resurrection or the concept of restoration, the concept of peacemaking, only living in like the sensational Jesus got up from the grave type of cataclysmic moments.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering that if that's what we believe this is, how often we're going to miss the seedlings breaking through the soil of a dark world and fresh life emerging all around us in all sorts of very simple and subtle ways. And I'm wondering if there's an invitation for us as well to be, yes, be both and people, but yes, be both and folk in like the simple micro everyday ways rather than waiting for big magic wand moments.
Yeah, no, you're right about that, because I think that to be quite frank, I have spoken to several people in my life who used to believe in the resurrection, and that felt too sensational for them. And so there's a disconnect between kind of the real life application of like, what does that mean in their lives? Because they don't believe in the resurrection as a significant moment. We do, but they don't. And I think that for me, as somebody who wants to have an expansive, wider table and make room for them to engage with that, the invitation to see the small deaths in their lives and little resurrections, for them to kind of see the through line or the connection piece between that, I think might give space for the Holy Spirit to help them kind of get their brain around the possibility of the resurrection. Because he has risen, we now have the blessing and the joy and the invitation to see all of life around us. Life still prevails. Life still overcomes death. And so I think that is a really important thing for us to claim in our actual everyday lives. So like, for instance, my husband has a chronic disease where he throws up for days on end. Like, that's a real dark moment for us. Like, those days when he is sick are really dark. As he begins to come out of it and starts moving from nothing into ginger ale and crackers and then to like, I had a moment of just like watching him enter back into like eating again. And that was a resurrection, you know, from somebody who could not keep anything down to now somebody who's keeping something down. That is a resurrection. And I think we practice hope and we build our capacity to see the power of the resurrection if we see it in our actual lives.
Well, let me share a story, because I think it maybe illustrates to the yes and, I think it also illustrates this longing that we have for the big resurrection. And I'm not saying we diminish that at all. Like, let's live with hope and anticipation that all of the wrong things will be unmade and remade, you know? And
yes.
And let's believe in the case, for example, of what's happening in Gaza right now, let's believe for an end to this violence and the emergence
yes.
of desperately needed hope and healing that actually leads toward a just and lasting peace between Israelis and Palestinians. Like, absolutely, let's believe and let's use our bodies to move in that direction. And there's going to need to be 1,000 little resurrections that happen along the way in order for that to be realized. So let me share this one story, because something just happened on Holy Saturday connected to a Gaza ceasefire pilgrimage. And for those of you listening in, you've heard Global Immersion talking about this global movement of pilgrimages, and there ended up being 173 organized across 19 countries on every continent on the planet. Just a sensational movement rooted in the Christian tradition of followers of Jesus putting our bodies in prayerful solidarity. It was an opportunity for thousands and thousands of us to move from information to transformation and from polarization to pro-humanity, which in and of itself, those transitions are little resurrections. Those are the little resurrections that I need inside of myself to move from a commitment from simple information to transformation and from polarization to pro-human. We actually organized one in Spokane, and the uniqueness to this pilgrimage is that it was actually going to go from the Washington-Idaho border to downtown Spokane. So this is Eastern Washington, and this journey was going to go right smack dab through some of the most intense and highly populated white militia and nationalist movements in the entire country. And we knew that. We also recognized that if we were going to be taking this journey, that therefore there would probably be some resistance to this. And so we did all sorts of work to prepare for that. Most notably, how do we hold a pro-human understanding of protesters or counter-protesters as we might encounter them? Early in the morning on Saturday, it's a beautiful day, the sun is rising, and we embark on this journey, and we get to our first stop, which was a sacred pause where we were going to do some liturgies together. And now again, the big resurrection that fuels this is an end to this horror. It has to stop.
Yes.
The bigger resurrection is that there's a just and lasting peace. So that's the big, we want to see that, and that will feel cataclysmic. You know, and so that's the fuel, that's the juice behind this movement. We pull into the first stop, and no sooner do we arrive than there's a few gentlemen that stand kind of up at the street level with Israeli flags and with signs that say things that are just dehumanizing, I think, to Israelis and Palestinians. I think it's dehumanizing for everybody. But they're very clearly pro-Israel, and in this space, you can assume that they probably identify as Christian, and they see their counter-protest, if you will, as an act of faithfulness. The gentlemen standing with the flags aren't saying anything. They're just standing there with their signs, dehumanizing signs, in my opinion. And I feel like every car almost that drove by them were honking in support of their message, because the cars couldn't actually see the pilgrims, we who were circled up and moving through a liturgy together. At the same time, there was a couple that had infiltrated into our group, and they were handing out little pieces of paper with the pictures of Israeli Jewish hostages and their name and, you know, a slogan of who they were kidnapped by, things like that. And they made sure that they had a whole bunch of these copies, and they're just kind of moving between, there's maybe 80 of us in this circle, and they're handing out these pictures of Israeli hostages, which I still have it, and I will hold on to it, and I will pray for this particular man until he's released, if he's still alive, God willing. But it was fascinating, because they're doing this, and it was uncomfortable for many of the pilgrims. And then we entered into the liturgy, and the couple that was handing out the pictures of the hostages just settled into our circle and began to listen to the liturgy and discovered how pro-human our liturgy was. It was an invitation. It was a message that centered Jesus and invited us to consider the pro-human implications, not the pro-one and anti-other the pro-human invitation to become the kind of person who can see the humanity, dignity, and belovedness in the person that you agree with and the person that you maybe disagree with. And they're listening to this liturgy.
Yes.
And then the pilgrimage restarts and people are on the trail. And I pull up next to this couple and I introduce myself. And the way that I would describe them as I watched them moving through the crowd was urgent. Mm-hmm. I would describe them as adamant. I wouldn't describe them as combative or antagonistic. I would say urgent and adamant. When I approached them after the liturgy, the pro-human liturgy, I would describe them as meek and gentle. And I noted it, and I just asked them, what was your experience? And first of all, what was your motivation in coming here and handing these? Thank you for these. And then secondly, what was your experience of being a part of us in that moment? Those were my only two questions. And their response, I'm not going to be able to quote them directly, but their response helped me understand something. And that was this, that for them, they were socialized into a theology and an ideology that was unquestioningly pro-Israel, which required them either knowingly or unknowingly to be anti-Palestinian. To be pro-one requires that you have to be anti-another. And so therefore, if they heard that something was going to maybe be pro-Palestinian, their automatic assumption is that it would therefore be anti-Israeli because that's their experience. And so they were there to make sure that the pain of our Israeli Jewish kin was going to be centered as well.
Yeah.
So what they discovered in our pro-human liturgy is that to be sympathetic to the plight of the Palestinians does not require us to be anti another group. We can be pro-Israeli Jewish and we can be pro-Palestinian and maybe even pro-Muslim. You see what I'm saying? We can be pro-human and it transformed their disposition to the point at which one of the two shook my hand, gave me a warm embrace and said, I think we actually can get behind what you're standing for. A little resurrection, right? And, and like I said at the beginning, the big resurrection is a just and lasting peace between two people who are at war with one another. It's going to take a million little resurrections in order to get there. And in this case, it was a little resurrection in a couple who realized that because of Jesus, we can actually be pro-human. And so I wanted to raise that up. Like, that's where I saw a mustard seed or some yeast or a little resurrection on Holy Saturday. And I'm like, ah, I want to continue to be a part of these moments, but I also want to be able to continue to see them and identify them and celebrate them when they happen. You get what I mean?
I get 100% get what you mean. And I just credit those counter-protesters for the humility to enter in, to be quiet, to participate in a liturgy that they might not agree with, they don't quite understand. I deeply believe, because I know you and because I know many people who are involved, that the atmosphere and the space was a space of grace and a space where they could enter in. And I just think that speaks a little bit to some interior work that we need to be able to do to be able to enter into the work of Yes And. And that interior work is that humility to enter into, to say, my way doesn't have to be the right way, or maybe there is another way. I don't know what it is, but I'm willing to explore it a little bit. I think for me, Yes But is so deeply tied to my anxiety. Like, I'm a very good, yes, this might be good, but da 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 da. Or yes, this might be possible, but it can never work, da da da. Like, yes, Jesus might be risen, but it's nonsense. I'm very good at stopping the flow of hope with my anxiety. And for me, as an anxious person, humility is not like, oh, you know, I'm a worm, or no, humility isn't, you know, all the kind of self-effacing things we think humility is. Humility for me as a person with anxiety is saying my way, the way that I think it is, not the only way, and it's probably not the right way, and there's a more expansive way. So yes, and. And that's what those counter-protesters did. They entered into that space with humility, and then the power of the and created a little resurrection, created an opportunity for peace and peacemaking. And I'm curious, kind of the conversations that they're going to have coming out of that, of like, oh, we thought it was this thing, but it's actually different. We thought these people believe this, but they actually believe something else. Oh, maybe I'm convicted. let me change the way I think. That's hopeful.
Yeah, absolutely. And you think about their yes and, because they absolutely identified as Christian. And, you know, like their yes and is, I would maybe place on them if I could just for a moment, getting playful, but like their yes is, there's something happening here that we fundamentally disagree with, and we might be wrong. Or yes, there's this thing that makes us uncomfortable, and we're going to get closer to it. Now, I don't know that they intended to get closer to it to understand it, but their and was, this thing is happening, and I'm going to get closer to it, which is actually different than the gentlemen who were standing up on the street with the flags, who they didn't immerse into it. They stayed distant with their ideology and their signage. This couple, there was something different about the disposition of this couple. On the other side of it, and this is for us as resurrection-oriented peacemakers, what if our yes and is, yes, your ideology is troubling to me, or yes, your presence makes me uncomfortable, or yes, I think a particular way about your approach, your values, and your voting, or yes, your theology feels self-serving, and I believe that you can transform and so can I. You know what I'm saying? It's like, I'm going to name my discomfort, and I'm going to actually believe that you and I can both transform. I wonder what it would happen if we as peacemakers carried that kind of yes and resurrection disposition into the kinds of interactions that we're having people, especially people who are theological or ideological others. Yes, your ideology is maybe troubling to me, and I believe you can transform. I believe I can too, you know?
Yeah, I, as you're talking, I'm thinking about the importance of space. I'm thinking about the importance of structure. I'm thinking about the importance of a community of peacemakers. And it's hearkening back to your experience around the fire with the music and the singing of the anthem in their language, and how that was a yes and moment, and how this is a yes and moment, and you have the liturgy and you have the community. Like, and so I, for me personally, when I hear somebody invite me into peacemaking with a yes and kind of posture, yes, I disagree with you, and I believe that we can honor each other, we can believe the best about each other, there can be transformation. When I do that, I get a little nervous because I'm like, I don't know how to do that. And I come into it as a woman of color. I come into that like, yes, and what they're saying brings up a lot of trauma for me, and I don't know how to deal with that. And so as I'm hearing you speak, I'm also thinking like part of my responsibility as a peacemaker is to kind of have, you know, my own interior framework for how I live into that yes and. So like if I am engaging with somebody that I fully disagree with, that me entering in with a yes and posture also means that I kind of, I maybe have in the back of my mind kind of the things that I want to share about my perspective, the ways that I want to honor their perspective and say that we have more in common than we disagree, you know? I want to have done a little bit of that work, which kind of like brings me to what I had talked about as kind of my closing in my sermon, of that hope is a practice skill, you know? It's not something, it's not optimism, it's not being Pollyanna, it's not being naive. Yes, and necessarily means we look at Good Friday, we look at the crucifixion, and we run towards the tomb. So it's not this naive way of moving through the world. It's a very open-eyed, open-hearted way. Hope invites us into open-heartedness, but we have to practice and we have to be prepared for it. And I think that's why, like, Journey of Hope, when we have these reconciling leaders together, you know, we're equipping them with tools and we're equipping them with a space for transformation to practice hope with each other so they can practice it within their context. We as everyday peacemakers need to be practicing hope. And so I invited my community at our church, Roots, to take stock of the little resurrections that they see in their life and to not explain them away. Like I could easily say, my husband has cyclic vomiting syndrome. He will vomit for 3 days and then he'll make his way out and then we'll be fine. That's just science. That's just the cycle of the disease. I could explain it away. But where's the hope in that? Like, where's the joy in that? Where is the life and light in that? Or I could say, if my husband has this disease and he has these horrible days, and then he makes his way out of it, and I can see his body, I can see his pallor changing, and I can see his body changing, and I can feel the weight in our home lift. Like, just changing the way that I talk about that in terms of like a darkness into a light, a death into a resurrection, allows me to have hope and experience hope. I also talked about the importance of community, because the women were the first ones to receive this message of hope from the angels, who were like, why are you looking for the living among the dead? And they had a responsibility to take this hopeful message and tell others. Mm-hmm. And so they had the capacity to see hope. And they went to some of the disciples and they couldn't see hope. And then Peter, he could. And so I think that, you know, when we are in a season where it is really hard for us to do the yes and, maybe like you're in a depressive spiral, things are really, really hard, whatever it is, we cannot see the empty tomb. All we see are Golgotha. Like, all we see is the crucifixion. That is important for us to have people who can see the empty tomb and say, no, yes, and the tomb is empty. Like, and to not be like, you know, it's not like throwing optimism on top of it, but saying like, yes, you are going through something hard and you're not alone in it. And I see this capacity or this possibility. Somebody that can have the faith and have the ability to live into hope for you when you're feeling hopeless is really, really important. And it's one of the ways that I have been able to be a peacemaker that sustained me, is when I struggle with believing that peace can happen in all of these spaces. Mm-hmm. I have somebody like you, Jer, who's like an eternal optimist. You are like one of the best hope dealers that I know. And you're like, no, you are a yes and voice in my life. And so I think it's important for us to foster relationship with people like the women at the tomb, who have the capacity to see the empty tomb and who have the capacity to say yes and for us, until we can say it for ourselves.
Yeah, right on. I think an invitation that I would offer, I think I'd actually pull from the couple that I had the privilege of interacting with. They, yeah, in some ways, practicing resurrection for them looked like catching wind of something happening that was troubling to them, and with courage, and again, I would use the words urgency and adamancy, they got closer to it. They got closer to something that they thought was horribly broken, and in the midst of that, were actually undone, and I think a bit remade, as we all were as a part of this pilgrimage. And so, being resurrection-oriented peacemakers, when we sense that something is happening in our midst, or when we find ourselves in a situation or a scenario where there's something going on that is troubling, what does it mean to move toward it? And I would say, do so with relational intention and with humility and with curiosity, understanding that immersion in that case, with compassion, gentleness, humility, curiosity, it cultivates the soil where these little resurrections can spring to life. And I think spring to life in all of us, not in them and that person as much as in me. I need resurrection to continue to come to life in me. The other thing I think I would point out in being resurrection oriented, yes, and expansive peacemakers in this way, is in the way that I drew close to them, I didn't draw close to them with explanations or with even assumptions about why they were there and what their impulses and values were and things like that. I drew near them with two questions. What brought you here? Because I actually want to congratulate their courage for being there. What brought you here? And what was your experience with us? The urgency and the adamancy was creating anxiety for some of my fellow pilgrims on the journey. So I knew that there was something, there was an energy that was going on that was going to probably require some kind of disarming or de-escalating. I wasn't sure what it was, so I wasn't going to make an assumption in drawing near them and doing a thing. I drew near them to ask about their motivation and their experience. And my objective there is to get them talking about like a story, talking about motive, talking about value. You know, because I can meet them there. I can't meet them in an ideological sparring match. I can meet them in their story. I can meet them in their ache. I can meet them in their value. So I think for us as resurrection peacemakers, drawing toward, getting near that which maybe is a bit troubling to us, doing so mm-hmm. with gentleness, with compassion, with curiosity, not to spar mm-hmm. ideologically, but to understand more fully. And I think in the process of that, what happened for them was that it grew their understanding and even belief in what was going on. What it did to me is it reinforced that, like, how often my assumptions about people can actually interrupt relationship and therefore my own transformation. So, like, I'm being transformed. Resurrection is springing to life in me because I recognize that those who maybe I would have written off as, you know, exclusively pro-Israel, anti-Palestinian, in fact, turned out not to be that. And, and I can literally feel the circle of my human concern growing as well, which too is a little tiny resurrection. So yes. Peacemakers, I'd invite us to practice that a little bit this week, maybe with someone that's more familiar to you, where there's some ideological or theological difference. Draw near with gentleness, humility, compassion, and curiosity. Learn their experience, their values, the story, rather than make assumptions about their ideology, and watch some resurrection spring to life.
Yes, that, and yes, and, you know, this can be practiced in the, like, the low stakes. I'm always like, how am I a peacemaker in these low stakes moments? Because then it becomes a part of my just muscle memory, my soul memory for when I enter into these higher stakes moments. So you and your partner are trying to decide where to have dinner tonight, and they suggest Wendy's. You could say yes, and they have fries. You know, like, yes, and I like burgers. How about this other place? You know, practice that. That's been hard, an expansive posture. When I first learned about this concept of yes, and it really is like, it's an improv, you know, technique where, you know, your scene partner offers you something and you can be open-hearted. You can be creative and you can receive it and roll with it, or you can do the butt, you can shut it down. And so, you know, think about how you can be a part of generating that positive, hopeful posture just in some low stake things. Like, your kiddos want snack. Yes, Cheetos and Capri Sun, or, you know, think about that and practice that in the low stakes, because God will bring these moments, like the counter protesters who will come near, and you might be the peacemaker that honors their dignity, that hears their story, that speaks to their ache and moves them from this kind of scarcity mindset of my way is only the right way, my position is the right position, to this abundance mindset, which is why we practice hope.
And so, friends, if you're rooted to the Christian tradition, we affirm that God waged a decisive peace in Jesus and it worked. And the empty tomb yes. confirms that wonderful, mysterious truth. And the world is being remade still here and now today through you and I, everyday peacemakers who are following the invitations of the Spirit into deepened relationships, into uncommon friendships, into unique experiences where we get to participate in these both yes and little resurrection mustard seed moments, life, newness, hope, and healing springing up all around us. And so go, friends, with that charge, with that impulse, with a resurrection impulse, with the high octane fuel of the faith that we claim in the resurrected Jesus this week.
Amen. Bye, friends.
The Everyday Peacemaking Podcast is a production of Global Immersion and is made possible by our Embers community of monthly donors.
Sincere thanks to The Brilliance for use of their song, Turning Over Tables. Learn more about the work of Global Immersion, forming everyday peacemakers and reconciling leaders to mend divides at globalimmerse.org.